Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Research shows that most Americans are worried about global warming, and there is widespread support for climate solutions and policies, like taxing companies for the carbon pollution they emit and transitioning to clean energy.
The reality is a vast majority of Americans want action on climate change. We want solar energy and wind turbines.
But Philip Newell of the Climate Action Against Disinformation Coalition says many people do not realize this. He says one reason is that fossil fuel companies have led lobbying efforts and PR campaigns that make people think climate solutions are more controversial than they actually are.
It makes you think, oh, it's not popular, and so we shouldn't be loud and vocal and proudly advocating for climate solutions.
He says sowing doubt about the popularity of climate action can make people nervous to publicly support clean energy, to advocate for climate policies, or even to talk about climate change with friends.
Like you're going to get yelled at if you talk about it, when in reality, you can be very confident talking about climate change with most of your friends and neighbors, because it is 60, 70, 80% of Americans that are supporting these issues. So not being afraid, not being bullied by the disinformation is one way they can start to push back.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Edwards' notion of oppositional intellectual is something that both he and Chomsky share. That is, the oppositional intellectual is guided by and actually is required to address people, not power, to enable people to resist power, to arm people with ideas and understandings, to be able to engage in creative forms of resistance. To me, that's the oppositional intellectual.
That's Nubar Hovsepian, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Nubar Hovsepian on Edward Said, an oppositional intellectual. From on high, establishment intellectuals replicate dominant societal narratives, power structures, and established norms. And, as long as they perform that task, they are honored, celebrated, and invited to all the talk shows and dinner parties of the rich and powerful, and get to play golf with them. And they are, of course, well rewarded financially. In sharp contrast are intellectuals who go against the grain, who rock the boat, who challenge the existing order, who contest the hegemonic discourse, who speak the truth and expose the lies and deceptions of officialdom. An oppositional intellectual not only questions mainstream ideologies and received wisdom, but offers alternatives. Edward Said was one of the 20th century's most influential intellectuals. He exemplified the oppositional intellectual who made the comfortable uncomfortable. And to talk about Edward Said is his close friend and confidant, Nubar Hovsepian. Nubar Hovsepian is Associate Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Chapman University in Orange, California. He edited and contributed to The War on Lebanon, and is the author of the book Edward Said, The Politics of an Oppositional Intellectual. I talked with Nubar Hovsepian in late May 2025. Welcome to the program, Nubar.
My pleasure, David. Good to see you, my friend.
Congratulations on your book, Edward Said, The Politics of an Oppositional Intellectual. You write in the preface that your book is guided by a simple inquiry. How does Edward Said's humanism inform his politics?
That's precisely the formula I followed. I did not want to write something that others are more capable of producing. There are others who dealt with his literary criticism, with his music and all that. But I was interested in explaining Said as a political person, right? He was not your average person who goes down on the street and demonstrates, but he was a person who involved himself in politics. And I wanted to see, is there a connection between his oeuvre, you know, Orientalism, culture and imperialism, etc., his literary articles in Raritan, etc., and his politics? And I felt that the humanism, which he describes in his book, Democratic Humanism, is what guides his understanding of not only Palestine, but what to do about Palestine.
You say Edward always insisted on the virtues of democratic humanism. What is that exactly?
Well, for Edward, you know, number one, he very much was hated being pigeonholed. He didn't, you know, he was criticized by people for not being a Marxist or not being a good Marxist or a bad Marxist. He didn't fit any mold. His mold was a democratic humanism that insists on the ability to see the other and to recognize that this form of humanism, it brings together a shared space to be able to create a better future. Right? So his democratic humanism has a theoretical, obviously, a philosophical underpinnings, but also a practical one, right? Because his democratic humanism insists on the politics of inclusion and not exclusion.
Inclusion without domination. That's a key theme there.
And that's precisely the critique he marshals of in his book on the question of Palestine in his second chapter. You know, Zionism from the standpoint of its victims. Okay? He says, you exclude me. The point is to be included, all of us, right? We don't want to eliminate anybody, but we want to be, we insist on being included because otherwise there is no solution.
You say that his literary career and politics feed into each other. Talk about that.
When you look at his early work, right? I mean, his early work was on the world dealing with beginnings, right? That's the title of his book. It's a brilliant book, but it doesn't show his politics as in a more pronounced fashion. But it's there. He's affected by Palestine from day one. It is muted in the early days, becomes more pronounced because he's living in America with the 67 war, all right? So in that sense, his humanism, his understanding that guides his work through Orientalism and the culture of imperialism, the world, the text, and the critic, these are just some of the titles, help him understand that what is needed here is to look at people, the rights of people, right? He's looking at people, the oppressed, those who are subjugated to colonial domination and who need to be freed. All of this, his humanism incorporates many things, including ideas coming from Fanon and from Cabral, from and then his most immediate mentor being Iqbal Ahmad.
The role of an oppositional intellectual, or the responsibility of intellectuals, to use the Chomsky term. Here he's influenced by Gramsci. They should not be intellectuals, experts in legitimation, and resist the lures of power. They should speak the truth, expose lies, hypocrisy, and deceptions.
Edward's view of the intellectual is kind of two levels. One, he articulates that view in his essays that were literally written for a radio broadcast, for the Reith Lectures in London, right? His essays on the intellectuals. They're useful, but I find something else. The notion of oppositional intellectual is something that both he and Chomsky share. That is, the oppositional intellectual is guided by and actually it is required to address people, not power, to enable people to resist power, to arm people with ideas and understandings, to be able to engage in creative forms of resistance. To me, that's the oppositional intellectual. Now, remember, David, in my book, I juxtapose that with the embedded intellectual, or you know, the servants of power, and those who sit on the fence. Those who serve power, they could come in all shapes, colors, and forms. The ones I identify who serve power very well, Bernard Lewis, Sam Huntington, and of course, Fuad Ajami and Kanaan Makiya. And former lefties like Christopher Hitchens, who joins the fray and becomes a neocon towards the end of his life. That's one form of intellectual who serves the interests of power. Another, Walter, which I find the most problematic, at least the others are clear where they stand. Walter theorizes that Camus, sitting on the fence in Algeria, is his model. Now, years later, Camus' Arabs, who are not part of his story in The Stranger, are written about by an Algerian writer who reimagines that and brings the Arab voice to the ground. So in other words, the muting the other is a conscious and deliberate act of obfuscation, which the Walters of the world engage in. So together, these intellectuals serve power or kind of justify it or rationalize it. The oppositional intellectual is one who resists the lures of power, who insists that speaking the truth is addressed to people so that they can oppose those in power. That, in a nutshell, is, I think, Edwards' view and practice. And on that, he and Chomsky literally are in agreement.
And if I could just add that Edward always challenged the hegemonic discourse on not just on Israel-Palestine, but on issues across the board. He opposed essentialism, dogma, and any kind of orthodox thinking. These members of the guild, as it were, become cheerleaders for war and empire. And in particular, native informants are given much prominence. You mentioned Fuad Ajami. There's also Kanaan Makiya.
I know both Fuad Ajami and Kanaan Makiya, knew them, right? Fuad Ajami was a graduate student at the University of Washington when I was an undergraduate in 68. He was fairly standard pro-Arab, pro-Palestinian, etc. In a few years, he emerges as Fuad Ajami that is loved by the American media, by Kissinger and others, because he's the Arab who tells them the truth about Arabs, which is to debunk Arabs. Now, Kanaan Makiya, on the eve of the first Gulf War, I actually invited him to speak in my class at Hunter College. And at the end of it, I asked him, do you have any fears, regrets, concerns that your people are going to be bombed tomorrow? He said no. I find that just absolutely incredible. Now, of course, he's a nobody today. He just had his name in the limelight for a little while. He served the neocon interest for a while, and then he was dropped because he was not useful, right? Neither did Fuad Ajami. These are the native intellectuals are useful to carry out the interests of the occupying powers, the interests of imperialist powers, and with a native face. And that's what Edward discusses in Culture and Imperialism. But I think more importantly, he sees these characters as people who need to be resisted because of what they obfuscate, what they eliminate, which is voice of the oppressed.
Where else does Edward get his intellectual nourishment? You mentioned Chomsky, of course, Gramsci, Iqbal Ahmed, Ibrahim Abu-l-Ghud. The last two, Iqbal and Ibrahim, were very close to Edward, and he dedicates Culture and Imperialism to Iqbal and Orientalism to Ibrahim and Janet Abu-l-Ghud.
Edward obviously has many influences. Some I just mentioned, but we really won't go through them. He, of course, deals with Foucault, and you know, in his work, he says, well, ultimately he differs with Foucault over the issue of the notion of resistance. Foucault sees systems as overbearing, whereas Said looks for ways to resist dominating systems. He didn't have much use for some of the postmodernists, and he disassociated himself from the postmodernists who viewed him as their star. So let's keep that aside. I make an argument that Edward's view of the intellectual is one that is based on activism. And precisely because of that, I say his book on intellectuals is a useful essay meant to be broadcast on the BBC. But if you really want to understand his view of the responsibility of the intellectuals, you see his association with Noam Chomsky as central. And when you look at the correspondence between them, it is a massive correspondence. They agree, disagree, but they just hold each other in high esteem. And I surmise that the way to see his view of the intellectual is to look at his fallen brothers. Iqbal Ahmed, 2 years later, Ibrahim Abu-l-Ghud, and then 2 years later, Edwards joins them, right? So in 6 years span, we lose three important figures. Now, Iqbal was a key figure. Edward was introduced to him through Ibrahim. Iqbal was a student of third world politics, of liberation movements, right? He was big in the U.S., right, during the anti-war movement. He was part of the Chicago, of the Harrisburg 7 case. You know, the government brought a suit against them, charging them with conspiracy to kidnap Kissinger, right? And, of course, they won the case because they had great lawyers and great support nationally. Iqbal introduced Edward to ideas about liberation movements. He, in many ways, he tutored him to some things. Of course, Edward knows a lot. It's not that he doesn't. But Iqbal kind of kept insisting about certain things. You know, the first and foremost, Iqbal resisted the idea that of worshipping of guns. He just found that to be absolutely short-sighted and irresponsible. Somebody like Cabral, really the theoretician of the African Revolution against Portuguese domination from Guinea-Bissau, he said, look, we will use violence, but ultimately we have to learn how to divide the forces of the enemy to win them over in order to win. In other words, Iqbal insisted on the need for militant struggle. And militant struggle does not necessarily mean armed struggle. It does not exclude it, but it can't be reduced to armed struggle. So Iqbal preferred nonviolent means. Edward saw that as valuable, right? And he then invited Iqbal to join him a couple of times to address his interesting ideas to the leaderships, both in Beirut and then later in Tunis. Iqbal's words fell on deaf ears with the leadership. But he left us with an important legacy, and that book produced by Columbia University Press of his writings are a gem that needs to be looked at. So Iqbal was crucial in his understanding. Ibrahim, on the other hand, is crucial in situating Edward's understanding in the immediate Palestinian context, not just history, but in the immediate context of the national movement and all that. Edward was a privileged person. He lived at, in New York. You know, the Palestinians needed somebody like him to identify with them. In fact, when the first time Shafi al-Hut, who was the PLO representative in Lebanon and a major figure in Palestinian history, he told me, look, first he hadn't heard of Edward, so he was curious to know who he is. And second, he said, well, we needed his solidarity. I find that interesting. As a Palestinian, Edward the Palestinian to be in solidarity with Palestinians. An interesting notion, because his presence would legitimize, would provide ways of explaining the rights of Palestinians, the justice of the Palestinian cause, right? So these two figures are crucial, Iqbal Ahmad and Ibrahim Abu Lawad, in informing Edward's understanding of political in the quotidian sense.
Edward also celebrates intellectuals outside the normal sphere in representations of the intellectual. That book, he celebrates James Baldwin and Malcolm X, whose centenary we just marked, incidentally, African-American stalwarts.
Edward celebrates Baldwin, and for good reason. I mean, I remember as a young immigrant, when I came to with my family after having left Cairo, and I went to Lebanon, and then we arrived in Seattle. And when I went to the university 3 years later, the first person that I was introduced to who taught me about the African-American experience was James Baldwin, right? I mean, his writings just resonated with me. And of course, Malcolm X is a fascinating figure and a historic figure. And Edward was amazed by both. Then in a more contemporary sense, I mean, Edward was supportive of Reverend Jackson's presidential candidacy, which was an important event in modern American history, Jesse Jackson. So he understood that experience and those two figures, plus others, obviously, right, as central to a understanding America. That's crucial. Understanding America means you understand it beyond the headlines that cover up those stories.
And Edward emphasized the need to understand your adversary, in this case, the Israelis.
Indeed. To understand the adversary does not mean that you have to have a power with them. What you need to do is first understand what they're doing, why they're doing it, right? That is, your adversary has to be understood in order to know how to confront them, how to weaken their resolve. This is what Iqbal insisted on, that a social movement, a liberation movement, its first task is to weaken the resolve of the adversary, right? Now, unfortunately, in Palestinian modern history, too many things have happened that strengthen the resolve of their adversary rather than weaken it. But that's a question of understanding how do you advance your cause? Do you advance your cause just by declaring, I did something, or do you do it by doing something effective? So in that sense, I think Edward was right on the mark, but that's the theme we see in all liberation movements. Cabral was the best. I mean, his understanding of Portuguese society was incredibly detailed. I mean, Edward did look at Cabral. Unfortunately, he doesn't give him as much space as Fanon. And Fanon deserves the space. I just think Cabral deserved more space in Edward's culture and imperialism. But he knew that Fanon and Cabral were of two historic figures that explain the need to dissect the interests of the adversary.
As well as Fanon's Martinican brother, Aimé César.
Of course, of course. I mean, see, Edward always refers to Aimé César. Cahiers au retour du pays natal. César, he always invoked that notion that there is room for all at the rendezvous of victory, a statement that César makes. And Edward invokes it on so many different occasions to the point when you read his work, you forget what is the original source of the reference from César. Edward not only looked there, but he also looked at other important figures, the C.L.R. James, also from that Caribbean. And you know, he did a long interview with C.L.R. James, and they talked a lot about C.L.R. James's love of cricket, right? I mean, he loved to write about sports as well. This great figure who wrote the Black Jacobins, right? That interview that I think was published in Interview magazine is a classic interview, as well as the interview he did on other subjects in that magazine.
Let's circle back to Yasser Arafat. One of the things that Iqbal advised him, and I believe Edward was present during this discussion, was to urge that Palestinians peacefully march to Israel's borders with signs saying, "We want to go home." That suggestion, among others, was ignored by Arafat.
See, unfortunately, this is an interesting point. I share it. But at the same time, let's remember that your adversary for now rejects any form of political gesture because they want to stamp you out. When Palestinians later on decided to have a march to the border in Gaza with Israel, it didn't last long, but it was an interesting gesture. It was useful. The point here is that Edward believed that one of the best ways, and this is something that Iqbal actually raised. Iqbal actually raised that idea in 1968, months after the 67 war. He addressed the Organization of Arab Students in the United States, and he proposed that idea from that time. So it's an early on idea. And what he did was to say that ultimately our struggle is a political struggle, that it must involve understanding the adversary and looking at what are the means and methods that weaken their resolve rather than strengthen their resolve. So in some ways, there are some, I know, in Palestine during the beginnings of the second Intifada, you know, some people called it Intifada al-Jidar, the Intifada that brought us the wall, right? And the question becomes, what was its purpose? It expresses the anger of the conquered over the conqueror. It expresses the resistance of the occupied to the occupier. But the question that still remains and that Edward would ask, what is it? How is it advancing one's objective? Right? So that's the criteria. He said, how do you measure it? You measure it by looking at what is it that advances the struggle versus that retards it as such.
Edward never joined the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, but he was for a time a member of the Palestine National Council, PNC. He and Abu Lughad and others muted their criticism of Arafat and the PLO. Why?
Edward was not an organizational man. I mean, I remember someone who tried to get Edward to join one of the organizations of the PLO. And he told me, Edward is unorganizable. Right? But why did Edward affiliate